This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
When a listener suggested we hear from Carrie Bowman about bioethics, I thought, bioethics? Who knows what that is? We don't have time for that in this climate emergency. But Dr. Bowman comes from the front lines. He was at the epicenter of the SARS outbreak in Toronto and had to be quarantined. Kerry was in the Congo finding the international trade of endangered apes. And just this summer, Dr. Bowman was the only Canadian in the Amazon able to report out the great fires of 2019. So this is everything but boring. Dr. Kerry Bowman is the clinical ethicist for Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto. He works in family and community medicine at the University of Toronto and serves with their centers for both bioethics and the environment. Kerry Bowman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Only slight correction there. I'm all University of Toronto now and no longer at Mount Sinai. But let me roll right in. How's that?
Okay, we've got that. So take us back to 2003. Why were you in a Toronto hospital where the police were called to empty out the place?
Well, I was there because I am a clinical ethicist. So that would be a person that's directly trained in bioethics working within the hospital setting itself. And although I'm a university professor, that is also the kind of clinical work that I have done for many, many years. So within a hospital, an ethicist might be involved in things like end-of-life decision-making, ethical questions and genetic testing. I'm Canadian, so we now have medical assistance in dying, meaning euthanasia, all of these types of things. So I was actually working in the hospital, you know, seeing patients and doing the many things that I do.
And could you talk to us about the links between the destruction of the environment and the most fearsome diseases like HIV, AIDS, or SARS, or Ebola?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a tricky link, but it's definitely, definitely there. So, you know, some of the worst diseases that affect humankind, it's really diseases that are called zoonotic. And just as the name would imply, these are diseases that come from animals. And so you can get these complex crossovers of, you know, diseases, viruses that are emerging from animals. So in the African context, HIV itself is zoonotic. And although they're not the original vessel species, often the great apes would in fact be carrying HIV in the original, a different version of it, more of an SIV. But the original crossover, and that goes back quite a long time, by the way, really would have come from chimpanzees to people. The destruction of the forests of Africa and the incredible onslaught in the last 20, 30 years, and this is escalating, by the way, in which the forests are just being opened right up. And they're being opened right up because of logging. And then the bushmeat trade, that refers to the killing, slaughtering, and eating of all animal species within the forest. This has opened up human exposure to new pathogens in areas of the forest that were really never fully opened up to human beings before. The destruction of the forest, the destabilization of the ecosystem, and the physical consumption of animals. So that includes Ebola. This is where Ebola is emerging from. So SARS itself was also, now SARS is not African, SARS emerged in Asia, and so SARS itself actually emerged because of, although it's called something slightly different, the bushmeat trade. It was an Asian species that was mixing with human viruses that really triggered the SARS epidemic. And remembering, the SARS epidemic hit the Far East quite hard, cities like in southern China and Hong Kong. The only place out of the Far East that really got hit at all was the city of Toronto, and it was the downtown teaching hospitals because there was a Chinese-Canadian that had come over, and she carried it with her. So that's how it all came together.
So you are a member of the board of the Jane Goodall Institute, and you founded the Canadian Ape Alliance. Briefly, what does your group do, Kerry?
Well, the Canadian Ape Alliance, we are a group that, you know, I was really pretty horrified by what I saw going on in Africa with the incredible destruction of the forest and the slaughtering of so many species under the bushmeat trade. And so one of the things that we really wanted to do and I really wanted to do was to try and protect areas and environment to try and counter that. And when I speak of this destruction, this is not really an African destruction at all. These are foreign multinational companies that are coming in and doing the worst of the deforestation. So although many African societies, most, have eaten bushmeat, it's always been occasional domestic use and in most cases sustainable. What has really pushed it much higher is turning this into a major commercial enterprise that aligns itself with the deforestation. So I was witness to just the massive decimation of the great ape populations of Africa, having worked and traveled there. So I wanted to set up a group. And when I say set up, I don't mean a foreign group where we're doing the work. We were partnered with a Congolese NGO over there, and the Congolese are doing the frontline work. We're advising on some of it. We're doing some of the fundraising. But with all of this type of work, the most important thing, you know, there's no way a person can be going into Africa and focusing only on non-human species. The reality, you know, the geopolitical realities are such that people live within the environment. People are dependent on the environment. So the group that we've set up, most of the work we do, we've done microloans for women. We've got an environmental school, agricultural projects. And really the philosophy being that we have to protect and enhance human life as a way of protecting the environment. Now, that kind of thinking is much, much more common than it used to be. And so most of our work is really, really with communities as well, as opposed to very, you know, systematic work within the parks of behavioral observation of primates. There's some of that. But under these conditions, the most important thing is really to be working with people and trying to protect the species that are most endangered.
As we speak, Indonesia and its neighbors are encased by smoke from burning rainforests, and the last home for orangutans is still being cut down for palm oil plantations and viscose to make high-fashion nylon clothes. Do you think the great apes will survive our onslaught, Kerry?
I don't know. I hope they will. And you know, the great apes are wonderful and spectacular species, but you know, we use them in many ways to protect the entire ecosystems that they live within. You know, people's consciousness about these matters has been rising very, very quickly, but so has the problem. And the amount of people that are aware of deep questions like palm oil and just how destructive it is and how serious the Amazon fires have been. Now, of course, the great apes are not in South America, but there's many, many other species, including many other non-human primate species. I certainly hope it will. But, you know, the strongest thing I take, and this is something I suspect, you know, your listeners have heard many times by this, but I'll just reinforce it. It's that, you know, drawing these sharp lines between the environment and people has not been successful. And what we really, really need to be doing is looking at the two things and ways to balance those things. Also, we need to be as consumers. When you speak of palm oil in Indonesia, you speak of Africa and wood, or I speak now of Africa and wood, we need to educate ourselves, because that is where we can be most effective, to not be tied up with these multinational corporations that are doing the most damage.
So high in the jungle of concrete that we live in, we feel a nervous disconnection from our natural selves, I think. And some people fly thousands of miles for ecotourism in Costa Rica. Others go to Africa or Alaska to shoot trophy animals. But the well-meaning and the cruel share the same thing, Kerry. The effort to reconnect with nature actually means more destruction of nature. Surely that's a problem for bioethics.
Yeah, it is, because the more, you know, ecotourism is a very, very mixed blessing. And, you know, the defense of it would be the educational component is significant, and it's there. People that go off and see, the ecosystems, the animals, come back with pictures, it's got an educational component. But when I think of ecotourism, I'm thinking often of the great apes and the gorillas. And, you know, it's a very mixed blessing. But I would say in Rwanda, more than Congo, because Congo doesn't really have tourism, the amount of money that has been infused for the protection of the forest and the gorillas from ecotourism is huge. Having said that, I am very mindful that this is not an ideal situation. It's not ideal for anyone. The gorillas, the ecosystem, they're being exposed to pathogens. They're kind of becoming almost zoo-like, in which there's very established paths and routines. And this may be the unfortunate reality of 21st century experiences with endangered animals, is they're kind of like you know, fenceless zoos in a sense, because ecosystems become so fragmented. And so it's a very mixed file on this one.
So if we lose beloved or necessary creatures, what do you think about de-extinction?
Well, de-extinction, you know, meaning that we're, you know, we're going to keep, as you know, DNA and you know, genetic files of creatures and then a species, and then we can bring them back, reintroduce them, those types of things. To state the obvious, we're not at all dealing with the heart of the problem. And it's beginning to take a lot of people and things off the hook, because people say, well, you know what, if the gorillas go, remember there's a different species of gorillas, but if the mountain or the lowland eastern or western gorillas go, we've kind of got them on file. But also from a point of view of genetic diversity, are you kidding? I mean, we have such small samples on file. I mean, this is no way a sustainable element to it. So some aspect of their existence will always be stored, whether it's created or not. But, you know, they're a part of their ecosystems, and an ecosystem is a part of them. All of that will be lost. And I really don't think we can take solace in the fact that de-extinction is becoming an increasing reality.
Well, it kind of reminds me of Jurassic Park. I mean, what could go wrong? But let's head to the Amazon, as you did in the summer of 2019. What was it like as the wildfires grew to world-threatening proportions again this year?
It was a nightmare. I found it very, very traumatic. I was in an extremely remote part of the Amazon, and way beyond electronic contact of any sort. And we were beginning to smell the fires as we surfaced closer, into a more habitable area of the Amazon with more people. And then seeing the extent of the fires was really, really, really disturbing. And yes, the Amazon has fire every year, but boy, I draw your attention to a few things. One, the Amazon is not evolved for fire. So there's forests in North America, Australia, where I'm not saying fire is great because they're getting so much worse. But, you know, you have things like pine cones that will generate after a fire, those types of things. The Amazon is not. And the reason it has so much fire is that it's being degraded and whittled away at, and then they burn the peripheral areas. And then the intensity of the fire, you know, can roll right into the primary forest areas. And the destruction of non-human life and multiple species is staggering. So yes, fire is common in the Amazon, but it's common from humans. And to say it happens every year, well, you know, the extent of the fire is much, much worse. I tie this directly to the shift in government in Brazil. And now there's 9 Amazon nations and they've all got their challenges, but Brazil is the largest component of the Amazon. And I tie this very much to the new policies of President Bolsonaro, who's anti-environment, anti-science, and anti-indigenous. And I know that sounds like a strong thing for me to say, but just look up some of his quotes and it's all there.
And you say fair treatment and protection of Aboriginal rights is not just an ethical problem for thinking people. But can we really make the case that Aboriginal rights are fundamental to the protection of nature, including the rest of us?
Absolutely, absolutely. So let's look at the Amazon. So large swaths of the Amazon are considered protected indigenous territories. And within those protected indigenous territories, there's little to no logging, like mostly none. And so by protecting indigenous territories, we are actually creating a carbon sink. And indigenous protected territories from a human rights point of view and an environmental point of view really, really needs to be respected and even expanded. It's good for all life forms on the planet Earth, including people. That's what's very much under attack right now. You know, and I would say further with climate change, the absolute experts on its shifting environment and environmental realities and, you know, food security and species are very often indigenous people. So the amount of knowledge that they hold, not just in mitigation, but adaptation and resilience is huge. And, you know, one of the real horrors, and this is happening all over the world, but we really see in South America, is the erosion of respect for indigenous people and territories. So that's a huge one. Also, please remember, the Amazon has, in the Western Amazon, where I am often, uncontacted people. People living beyond any interaction with 21st century society at all. And these people are very much living in complete balance with the environment, and also their lives are on the line with this situation.
In many public venues, you've said we need input from diverse communities. Who are the communities put at risk by climate change who are not being heard in Western media much or at international conferences like the recent one in Madrid?
Yeah, you know, the problem is with so much with climate, it's falling so heavily on academics and researchers. And essentially, the people most affected by climate change are the people with the least voice. They're also the people that have contributed the least to climate change. So, you know, many people in the global south have contributed the least to climate change and are most affected from it. If you have money and you live in a nice house and you have air conditioning and heating, none of which is good, but you're really buffered from it. If you're living close to the earth in the global south, much more so. Those are the voices. It's getting better, but those are the voices that are least often heard, including Indigenous people. And that's one of the problems, is we've got to break out of this sort of academic-only cycle of looking at climate. There's a lot of science involved, but there's a lot of humanity. There's a lot of geopolitics. There's a lot of everything involved.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Kerry Bowman, a specialist in bioethics and a conservationist. We're talking about right action in a world now going wrong. Kerry, you help countries form policies. Tell us about your work and what you found in North Korea.
Yeah, you know, North Korea, believe it or not, and I say believe it or not because this might surprise some people, it actually does have a considerable environmental concern and really has for quite some time. So part of what drives North Korea's environmental concern is, you know, they're very isolated. So if there's a flood or a famine or something, which there has been in North Korea, you know, most countries, if we have a crisis, we help each other out. You know, North Korea, with the ambivalent exception of the People's Republic of China, is really very much on their own. But they had a huge amount of deforestation. And in the late 90s, they had some really serious problems with crop failure. And since that time, they're looking much more at sustainability. So, you know, North Korea actually is doing a lot of work with tree replanting, green roofs, those types of things. And so I, with the Jane Goodall Institute, was there looking at bringing in educational plans for people in North Korea, you know, just bringing in ideas and concepts, mostly for youth education, because they're incredibly mobilized because of the way they organize their society in a way that we could hardly even imagine mobilization, whether it's a classroom or an office building. You know, it's highly militarized. I've never seen anything like it. So in a lot of ways, they can execute these initiatives quite quickly. So there was a sincere search for ideas related to the environment. Now, we all know the other side of North Korea. It's a big, huge challenge, but they are trying. And then we would think, well, why do you need foreign people going there? I mean, they can just go online. Well, no, they can't, because remember, that's the only country in the world that can't go online. They're not allowed. So they're moving towards an intranet within the nation, which they mostly have now. But they don't have open access to the internet. So you can't just hand out a bunch of websites and say, we'll help you and we'll correspond by email. So there really was a very sincere focus on developing these things. And I would also say what was really good about the initiative is it gave them a chance to see, it really created a space where they could see that we as foreigners, I was on very small delegations, I was once in there on my own actually, they could see that we're really not what they were told we are. And we could see the same thing, that they're really not what we were told they are either. They're not mindless automatons. And that was very, very useful, these kind of cultural exchanges. And there's not a lot of them, mind you, but we did that about three times. And I think it was quite useful. This was before the change in the U.S. government. And, you know, a big influence on North Korea will be how the U.S. reacts to them. That's always been the case. So these were in earlier days. I was there before 2015.
And as we talked about, you have a wide range of jobs. What took you to Iran?
I was in Iran at a United Nations conference on looking at global ethical standards in Iran, including reproductive ethics and those types of things. So, yeah, I was interested in Iran. I actually met the president of Iran. I met a couple of the president, the former president, some people on the Guardian Council. And, you know, again, when you actually get into environments like this, you know, you find shared ground very, very quickly with people when you're looking at shared ground and you've got shared goals. And these kinds of exchanges can be extremely useful. And, again, so that people can see how you live and how they live, it was actually quite a positive experience.
Why did you call for early warning systems for climate change, and what did you mean?
Well, just to have a sense of what the indicators are. So early warning systems can be defined in different ways. But, you know, we really need to have a readiness to climate change, and we really need to have a way of being prepared for climate change. So we need early warning systems if there could be shifts in weather or storms or those types of things. And it's part of an overall capacity to build up resilience. You know, one of the real challenges from an ethical point of view with climate change is we've got mitigation. That means more or less, let's not make it any worse. And then we've got adaptation and resilience, which means let's adapt to it and let's bounce back from it. But here's the ethical challenge with that is these days we're focusing so much on adaptation and resilience. So that means let's adapt to it and let's bounce back from it. None of that deals with mitigation, which is how do we keep it from getting worse? And what's our obligation to future generations? That's, I find, very much falling off the radar. And there's an element of a little bit of giving up with this. Let's just adapt. And, you know, adaptation in 2020 will look very different than adaptation in 2080 or something, because it's going to continue to keep mounting. So I think we have to be very, very mindful to keep mitigation. Let's not make it any worse. Let's not keep contributing to it, to keep that central and not just focus on adapting.
So I want to go back a little bit to a panel discussion you participated in 2013, and something you said there. You were talking about multiple sclerosis and the cures for it, but this really seemed to click with something I've been thinking about climate. Here's what you said. You said, how did we ever get to the point where hope is a negative or dirty word? We can't have hope. We can only have evidence. The last thing we ever want is an approach where something like hope is purposely suffocated in people because it's not, quote, rational. So let's turn that towards climate change, where I find hopium is discouraged by some activists. They call it hopium. And scientists continually say, well, we have to wait for more research. Does your worry about hope apply to climate change as well?
Yeah, I think hope has to stay alive because, I mean, you know, once it's gone, we've got paralysis. We've got complete paralysis. And, you know, that's a very bad thing. And one of the things that really can suffocate hope is that people say, well, I'm one person. All the odds are against me. What can I do? But a person, an individual, can do a tremendous amount. We interface with all kinds of people's lives. And what I worry about is that, you know, if hope is suffocated, people will see themselves as being powerless in the face of this. So I do think we've got to keep hope alive and hope that the individual can make differences, including committing to larger, you know, differences on a much larger scale as well. But individuals can do a lot. You know, I'll give a very strong example. I've known and worked with, she's a good friend of mine, Jane Goodall, for many years, and she is one person, and take a look at what she has done. Now, I know we could say, well, we're not all Jane Goodall, and I get it. I'm not either. But boy, the individual can do a lot.
Now, it sounds macabre, but I'm wondering if your experience at the bedsides of people deciding when to die could apply to our own sort of psychology of perceiving mass extinction these days. Can hospice tell us something meaningful about our threatening situation?
I think it probably can. I mean, one of the things that we see so much at the bedside is sticking with the kind of reasonable choices that people have and respecting those choices and allowing the people to make decisions about what it is that they would want. And so, too, with a changing environment, you know, we still have a decision-making element for it. And I think that's very, very important. We can still stay in control of these things. So that's very important. And bedside work in Canada, it's been quite a journey because, you know, being Canadian, in the arc of my career, I'm seeing things at the bedside that, you know, if anyone was assisted with dying early in my career, that would have been a homicide charge. Now as a Canadian, we have medical assistance in dying. So I've seen a huge transition within this. And, you know, I have some mixed feelings about it. I'm very supportive of it, but I see it as ethically complex. But it also shows how far we can progress, even in a relatively short period of time, and how much human rights can be respected. And there's a relationship between human rights and environmental rights. So a lot of good things can be accomplished.
The timeless importance of families used to ensure a duty to protect future generations, but now it seems like that is failing. Humans so far are choosing to keep consumption and fossil fuels over protecting our own kids and grandkids from a climate disaster. What has happened to us, Kerry?
You know, we've never been great at what I'm going to call, and others have called, intergenerational ethics, particularly for the forward movement. We're very concerned about our children, as we should be, and that's a healthy and beautiful thing to do, and our grandchildren to some extent, and then it tapers off. But, you know, one of the biggest ethical questions with what we're facing environmentally is our responsibility to future generations. So some hardcore philosophers will say, well, you can't worry about people that don't exist yet, but that becomes a very academic argument. I would say that people looking back on us 100 years from now, or more, even less to some extent, you know, are going to say, what were people thinking in the early 21st century? You have people that, you know, by 2020 had not modified their behavior in any discernible way. It's going to be a shock. And I think we have to, it's really the first time in human history where we could possibly do this much harm to people that have not yet been born. And I'm speaking beyond our children and grandchildren. I'm speaking further out than that. We've never been in a position where we could do that much harm. And I would also say that, you know, for those of us who are living now, we are the most important generation, perhaps, in a lot of the human story, because we're either going to rise to this or we're not. We have power, and we have a kind of power that we may not want, but we have, whether we acknowledge it or not.
You're kind of a complex guy. You volunteered to study orangutans, got a master's in social work, then a doctorate in bioethics. I wonder, does that fit together somehow, and where do you see yourself going in the 2020s?
You know, at first I thought it didn't. At first I thought, oh my God, I've got these two parallel careers that don't have a lot to do with each other. I don't think that anymore because, you know, my work in ethics and my work in environment have increasingly merged. If you look at even the health element, the disease front, as I spoke about zoonotic diseases coming from great apes and the horrible things happening to great apes and affecting people or SARS. So there's crossover there. And I now teach full time at the University of Toronto. And, you know, I see it when I teach that I can very much move between environment and people more and more smoothly. In the 2020s, you know, as life progresses and I grow older, I'm leaning a lot more towards trying to do environmental work. This is the issue of our time. I don't know what I can accomplish, but I'm certainly going to try, and I'm going to try very, very hard to raise awareness about certain programs, to build some projects, and to continue to do that. I find my students are absolutely hungry for it as well, and hopefully some of them will feel a sense of encouragement to move forward with this kind of work as well. In fact, I know they will because a lot of them are very committed. So I'm kind of feeling good about being in a position to hopefully make myself useful.
From the University of Toronto in Canada, we have been speaking with Dr. Kerry Bowman, and you can find links to follow up on Kerry and our discussion in my weekly show blog published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Kerry, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for your time.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.